The Placing You First podcast begins in less than 20 seconds.
Visit crcgroup.com to subscribe, download our award-winning tools and intel articles that help you stay aware of emerging issues and trends, or get a snapshot of the insurance marketplace with our industry-leading Ready Indexes. You'll find it all on crcgroup.com under Tools and Intel.
This special episode of the podcast was developed for behavioral healthcare providers, and we go pretty deep into how healthcare providers can best navigate the challenges with telemedicine, HIPAA, etc. If you're an agent and do not have behavioral healthcare insureds, be sure to take a listen to our previous or future podcasts that are focused on providing helpful information for retail agents. This is the Placing You First podcast. I'm Dan Wentz, and this podcast features news and insights from CRC's vast knowledge base of 2,000-plus associates who write in excess of $8 billion in premium annually. And we're giving you insider access to what's happening in our company and the types of insurance we place. On this edition of the podcast,
one of the things that we've noticed in many, many of our cases is that the validity and reliability of judgments about risk and treatment related to suicide and violence to others, and also legal risk for the provider, is greatly affected by the quantity, the quality, and the relevance of critical information gathered about the patient. And in the telehealth context, timely gathering adequate critical information from sources other than the patient can be more challenging.
This is the Placing You First podcast.
Today we're discussing telemedicine, a topic that has become more important with the current situation surrounding the coronavirus, COVID-19. We're joined by Sue Cohen, who's the Executive Vice President of Negley Associates, which is a CRC group company. And Sue, can you quickly tell us about Negley, what you guys focus on, and how that plays into today's topic?
Sure, Dan. Thank you so much. Negley Associates is the industry leader for insurance solutions for behavioral healthcare, addiction, and related social services. We are 100% focused on this and nothing else, and are the only insurance partner endorsed by the country's two leading trade associations and have been since 1986. Also, MHRG, the industry's own captive insurance company, entrusts Negley as their underwriting manager since its inception back in 1986. As the industry leader, it is important for us to offer not only insurance protection, but it is our responsibility to create and share the best practices on how the industry can mitigate existing and new risk exposures they face. We develop an individualized approach to coverage and risk management, crafting coverages and programs to fit the unique operations of each insured, and the current environment has increased the need and highlighted our differentiated strength in a very meaningful way. The unprecedented COVID-19 pandemic has significantly expanded the use of telemedicine throughout the behavioral healthcare industry. Working to help as many patients as possible via telemedicine has created a unique and new exposure. Behavioral healthcare providers need to effectively manage all of these, including ensuring that all appropriate insurance coverage is in place. To discuss this topic and provide a framework for agents and insureds to consider, Negley Associates and the Mental Health Risk Retention Group is pleased to introduce Ron Zimmett, a Florida trial lawyer, general counsel for the Mental Health Risk Retention Group, and a risk management expert in behavioral healthcare and to Negley Associates.
Thank you very much, Sue. Appreciate that. Ron, welcome to the podcast. We're here to talk about confidentiality and telehealth issues during the COVID-19 emergency and obtaining that information that is so critical to assessing and treating the risk of suicide and violence to others. Could you tell us why you chose this subject?
Sure, Dan, I appreciate it. You know, one of the things that insurance companies do for our insureds is we defend them in lawsuits when they get sued. And at Negley and MHRG, we believe that there's a lot to be learned about quality of care from a careful clinical and legal analysis of specific litigated cases. And one of the things that we've noticed in many, many of our cases is that the validity and reliability of judgments about risk and treatment related to suicide and violence to others, and also legal risk for the provider, is greatly affected by the quantity, the quality, and the relevance of critical information gathered about the patient. And in the telehealth context, timely gathering adequate critical information from sources other than the patient can be more challenging, because of the logistics of getting initial written signed confidentiality releases. Those logistics can make it more difficult. So I want to talk about a number of things that have to do with telehealth and confidentiality. And the first is, what do confidentiality regulations allow you to do when you don't have a signed release? And we'll talk about some exceptions to HIPAA, and we'll talk about principles of the 42 CFR Part 2, which of course is the confidentiality regulations related to substance use treatment. We'll talk about why it's important to have information from other sources. We'll talk about why it's important to have information from sources in addition to the patient when assessing and treating for risks of suicide and violence to others. And then, when do you need that critical information? And then, because telehealth has become so prevalent nowadays, some risk management suggestions about telehealth sessions. And because risk management includes good insurance, some important insurance issues as well. So first, why are other sources of information important? Why should you seek sources beyond that of the patient? Well, there have been a number of studies that are really pretty relevant and pretty important in this area, one of which was a survey of 547 clients of therapists. And they came up with what is, to me, is a pretty shocking number. 93% of those clients in the survey admitted lying in therapy. And they weren't just lying about inconsequential things. They were lying about things like, I'm not having any suicidal thoughts. And they were well-meaning, the folks who were lying. They didn't want to upset their therapist. They wanted to be polite. And similarly, patients who are potentially violent easily disclaim their violent propensities, even when they may be thinking about some violent thoughts. You know, it makes sense, actually. Think about it. Some patients don't want to get in trouble if they admit that they're having violent thoughts. They might not want to go to the hospital. They don't want you to think they're a violent person. They don't want to think of themselves as being a violent person. And similarly, with suicide issues, suicidal patients who are the most intent on suicide are the most likely to want to deceive. In a recent study, 78% of patients who actually died by suicide, one of their last verbal communications before killing themselves was to deny suicidal thoughts. And again, they may be motivated by a variety of different things. Maybe they don't want to go to the hospital when you ask them if they're having suicidal thoughts. They don't want to upset you. They don't want you to interfere with their suicidal intentions. One of the things that's important to remember here about getting additional sources from the patient is that there are risk management issues here about your own risk, because there are a fair number of cases which have held that if you make your decisions about interventions, if you make your decision about treatment, if you make your decisions about safety planning with inadequate information and consultation, then you're potentially at risk for legal liability. And the consensus in the literature and the experts in the field out there is that you want to seek information from other sources, such as family and friends and professionals, criminal justice records, healthcare records, past victims of violent attacks, social service records. So a variety of different sources. And the consensus, again, is that if you limit the quantity and quality of the information that you receive, you're setting fundamental limits on the reliability and accuracy of your judgments. So bottom line is, you want to get a variety of sources. Now, sometimes people tell me, Ron, you don't have to tell us that. We know that we should get collateral source information. The thing is, however, that in a lot of the litigation that we participate in, and we've been in literally thousands of cases, what we see is a lot of that basic information is missing.
So, Ron, when do providers need the critical information about risk?
Well, that's an important question, Dan. Thanks for that one. When do you need the information? One of the things that we've noticed in many of our cases is that there really is a short time between last contact with a provider and a suicide or attempted suicide or a violent act. And when I say short time, it can be the same day or a day or two later, something like that. There are some more dangerous times that have been identified in the research that surround violent episodes and suicide issues. One of the reasons that we know it's important to get information fairly quickly is because of the studies out there about violent episodes and about suicide issues and when are the most dangerous times. One of the studies indicate that if there's been a violent episode in a week before hospitalization, that patient is 9 times more likely to be violent again within 2 weeks of discharge. So if you're doing an intake assessment and making intervention decisions within 2 weeks of discharge for that patient, boy, that's information that you need, critical information from other sources. And the same is true of suicide issues. The studies indicate a variety of things here. One study indicates that the suicide rate is highest within 3 months after discharge from a psychiatric hospitalization for a suicide attempt. Another study demonstrates two sharp peaks of risk for folks who are in a psychiatric hospitalization for suicide issues. And one is the first week before the admission, and another in the first week after discharge. So if you're seeing a patient 6 days after discharge, boy, you need as much information as you can possibly get. You need it, bottom line, is as soon as you can possibly get the information and when you're doing intake sessions.
Okay, Ron, so what about some specific risk management suggestions about confidentiality specific to the telehealth intake assessments and therapy sessions?
Well, you know, just stating the obvious, telehealth is different than being with somebody in the same room and talking with them. And we do see some issues that relate to confidentiality around telehealth. Cybersecurity is, boy, it's really an important issue nowadays. There's an inherent cybersecurity risk to doing telehealth over the internet. And we think you ought to disclose that to let people know. And then you're not sure who else is in the room with the patient. If they're doing it from home or in other locations. So you might ought to disclose that it's possible that other people might overhear and ask, is there somebody else there? And is there some way that you can be private if you want to be private? You know, unlike when you have regular office visits, the presence of other people might not necessarily imply the patient's lack of objection to your making disclosures. Inherently, when you're in the same room together, we imply that it's okay with the patient for you to make disclosures and to talk about issues with the other person there. But that might not be the same over telehealth, because there could be people in the same room with the patient at home against what the patient wants. So important to make those disclosures, ask the patient if he or she wants other people to hear or to participate in the session, and then follow the patient's wishes on that, and then, of course, document those disclosures and answers to the questions.
All right, so we've learned that it's really important to obtain information from as many sources as possible in addition to the patient. Can you enlighten us what the confidentiality regulations allow if a provider cannot get a signed confidentiality release? Do providers always need a signed release to gather information?
Well, you know, that's a big question, because when I talk to people all over the country, they tell me that they don't gather information unless they have a signed release, because HIPAA requires that. So do you need a signed release all the time? And the answer is no, you don't. You can gather information without a signed release in a couple of ways. Actually, more than a couple of ways. I take that back. You want to, of course, distinguish between disclosures and receiving information. HIPAA is a regulation about what you can or cannot disclose, but it in no way prevents healthcare providers from listening to family members or asking questions without implying identity. So if there's somebody else in the same room and it's okay with the patient for that person to be in the room, you can say, is there anything you'd like to tell me to that other person? And you haven't disclosed anything by asking a question like that. Sometimes people will tell me, Ron, you don't have to tell me it's okay to receive information and to listen, because I know that's okay. But again, what I hear from a lot of folks I talk with is, I don't talk to anybody else unless I have a signed release. So HIPAA is about what you can or cannot disclose, but you can sure listen to what other people have to say. And then you also want to remember, and I think some people don't know this, a patient who is capable of making a decision about disclosure or not disclosure can give consent to your disclosure without signing a release. Interestingly, HIPAA does not require that a healthcare provider document the patient's agreement or lack of objection. You don't have to document it. Now, I'm a lawyer, so I'm not going to tell you shouldn't document it. You ought to document the agreement in your notes. But HIPAA doesn't actually require that. It's a good idea to document it, but you don't always have to have a signed release. If the patient is capable of giving consent, he or she can give that consent without signing a release.
Okay, so what about disclosure? Are there times when a provider can disclose information without consent from the patient?
And yeah, for sure, Dan, there are some exceptions to the HIPAA disclosure prohibition. And I think the folks who wrote HIPAA did a really pretty good job when they balanced the need for the patient's need for privacy and having a good therapeutic relationship with the provider's need to obtain critical information for quality care and patient safety. One of those exceptions relates to obtaining records from other healthcare providers. So let's just assume, for example, that you're at intake and you have a patient who was recently released from a general hospital following an emergency room assessment for attempted suicide. And you're talking to that patient 6 days after the discharge from the emergency room. Now, of course, if you're going to request records, you do want to remember that you can only disclose the minimum amount of information that you need to disclose. So, for example, if you're going to request records from a hospital, you could say something like, John Smith has an appointment for an intake assessment, and we need your records for treatment purposes. That's all you need to disclose to get the records. The HIPAA regulation specifically says that a covered entity may disclose protected health information for treatment activities or healthcare provider. So you don't need a written, signed release in order to get records from another healthcare provider that you need for treatment purposes. Now, there is an exception to that rule, and that is for psychotherapy notes. Psychotherapy notes do need to have a separate consent. And what are they? Notes recorded by a mental health professional. That's there are three elements, by the way, to what constitutes a psychotherapy note. And the first element is notes recorded by a mental health professional. Second element is those notes document or analyze the contents of a conversation during a private counseling session. And the third, the notes have to be kept separately from the rest of the patient's medical record. If you don't have all three elements there, it's not a psychotherapy note. HIPAA has a list of things that are not psychotherapy notes that you can obtain without that special consent. So, for example, information about medication prescription and monitoring, information about counseling session start and stop times, about the modalities and frequencies of treatment furnished, about the results of clinical tests, summaries of diagnosis, functional status, treatment plan, prognosis, and progress to date. So a psychotherapy note and a progress note are significantly different concepts. Now, there's an exception to the exception. You cannot disclose psychotherapy notes, but if there is a mandatory disclosure that's required by law, such as a mandatory report of child abuse or mandatory duty to warn, then you can use information in the psychotherapy note without getting a consent as well. So now let's muddy the waters a little bit. Let's say the suicide attempt that we're thinking about, that was the cause for somebody being in the emergency room. Let's say that attempt was by an opioid overdose and the emergency room doctor treated that overdose. That brings into play issues that relate to 42 CFR Part 2, the Substance Use Disorder Confidentiality Regulations. May the hospital still send you the emergency room records without a release? And the answer is yes, they can. And the reason they can is because the general medical facility and the emergency room doctor aren't regulated by 42 CFR Part 2. Those regulations apply only to programs as defined specifically by the regulation. What's a program? It's an individual or entity other than a general medical facility, which holds itself out as providing and which provides alcohol, drug diagnosis, treatment, or referral for treatment and is federally assisted. Or it can be an identified unit within a general medical facility which holds itself out. Or it can be medical personnel or the staff in a general medical facility whose primary function is providing alcohol, drug diagnosis, treatment, or referral. So it doesn't apply to everybody. And if it doesn't apply to the general medical facility, they can send you records that you request for treatment purposes. All right, there are some other important exceptions as well, and those are the incapacity exception and the serious and imminent threat exception. What is the incapacity exception? Let's say that you're doing an intake assessment and you notice that your patient is so depressed that he can't concentrate on your questions sufficiently to provide a complete or reliable answer. Let's say that happens. Can you then say, you know, I've got to get information from other sources, and you know that there's the patient has a wife who's involved in the patient's care. Could you then call the wife separately without a consent and disclose that you're a healthcare provider and ask about the circumstances of a recent attempt and a history of past attempts? And the answer is yes, you can. If the patient is incapacitated or under emergency situations And you conclude that the patient cannot meaningfully agree or object to disclosure, and you think it's in his best interest for you to talk to people who are involved in the patient's care. You can do that. That's one of the exceptions to HIPAA. Another really important exception is the imminent threat exception, where you conclude that the patient poses a serious and imminent threat to either his own or someone else's health or safety. HIPAA does allow you to make disclosures to anyone who's in a position to prevent or lessen that threat. That's different than the incapacity exception we just talked to. When you're working with the incapacity exception, you disclose information to people involved in the patient's care. When you're thinking about disclosures under the imminent threat exception, you may disclose to people who are in a position to prevent or lessen the threatened harm. And I just want to emphasize especially, the serious imminent threat exception relates not just to the kind of Tarasoff issues that we know about, where there's a duty to warn or protect other people, but it also applies to a threat to the patient's own safety. Now, here's the good news. If you have somebody challenging your decision as to whether the threat was serious or imminent, HIPAA has a specific provision that says we're going to expressly defer to the professional's judgment about whether the threat was serious and whether it was imminent. And that makes a lot of sense, actually, because think about it. The healthcare professional who's right there with the patient, either telehealth or in person, you get to pay attention to body language, you get to pay attention to word choice, you get to pay attention to where the patient is hesitating. So you have a good deal more information than somebody down the line who's just going to read the record. So we defer to your professional judgment. And that's important that we do that because we don't want you to hesitate to disclose information to people who are in a position to lessen a threat. Now, what about 42 CFR Part 2? How does that apply to an agency where you're a comprehensive community mental health center and you've got a substance use treatment program as part of your behavioral health care services? Let's say then that you think that there's a concern. May you then talk to the patient's wife if HIPAA allows you to? Disclose that you're a healthcare provider at a ABC Comprehensive Community Mental Health Center. And during the assessment, ask about, have there been recent attempts and what's the history of past attempts? Can you disclose that information? Well, we want to think about what is the evil that 42 CFR Part 2 is regulated to prevent. And the evil is disclosing that the patient has a drug or alcohol problem or as a participant in a drug treatment program. We don't want that information to get out and into the world without consent, because the fact of the matter is people who have problems like that, they get discriminated against. So you can't disclose that information. But if you work in a mixed-use facility, calling somebody up and saying, I work at ABC Comprehensive Community Mental Health Center, you are not necessarily going to disclose that the patient is there for a drug treatment program or an alcohol treatment program, because it's not clear. Your agency provides other services as well. So when you talk to anybody and you're relying on the mixed-use facilities concept, you don't want to go on to say, oh, by the way, we're treating for drug or alcohol problems.
Okay, so how has the COVID-19 pandemic changed some of the confidentiality rules? I'm sure there's a lot that we have to go through with that.
Well, actually, what's interesting is that they haven't actually changed the rules. What they've done, the Office for Civil Rights has done in regards to HIPAA, is they've issued a guidance that says we're going to use our discretion in enforcing HIPAA. And specifically with regards to telehealth, they've decided that as long as you're providing telehealth in good faith, then they're not going to enforce some of the issues that apply to HIPAA. So, for example, if you're providing the telehealth over a software platform that doesn't specifically comply with the HIPAA compliance regulations, they're not going to enforce those regulations for a period of time. Now, the telehealth does have to be provided in good faith. And what does that mean? Well, for example, if you use FaceTime, that's okay. But if you use TikTok, that's not okay. And why would that be? Why would that be different? Well, TikTok is what is called a public-facing platform. That is, anybody who records on TikTok is going to disclose information to the general public. But FaceTime, on the other hand, although it's not HIPAA compliant because Apple won't sign business associate agreements, FaceTime is not directed at the general public. Another part of good faith is you sure want to comply with state licensing laws. So if telehealth is being provided in one state and you've got a patient in another state, you want to look to what the state requirements are as to whether or not the provider has to be licensed in both states. But there have been a fair number of waivers by states of those laws recently as well.
Because of the increased challenges in providing quality behavioral health care during the COVID-19 emergency, good insurance coverage is especially important. What are some questions that insurance brokers should be asking the provider's telehealth practice to help insurance underwriters?
And boy, Dan, you're absolutely right. Good insurance coverage is especially important nowadays. And we think that the important part here is to remember that it's important to communicate directly with your broker so that brokers can provide information to the insurance company about exactly what's going on with your practice now, because there are so many changes to make sure that you get the insurance that you want. So here are some questions that you want to make sure the broker knows about or that the broker can ask you. Does the client use a telephone or video or both for telehealth? Is the software used HIPAA compliant or subject to some type of a waiver? Does the client separately disclose confidentiality risks of telehealth and obtain informed consent? How is that consent documented? Are providers licensed in the state where the patient is located, or is there a state waiver? Or does the client provide telehealth training for its employees? So the bottom line here, we want to make sure that the brokers know what's going on and that the brokers communicate that to the insurance company as well.
Thanks, Ron. Great information there. Sue, what do you feel the key takeaways are from Ron's presentation today?
I think that with the changing environment that we are in, communication is key. And what I mean by that is make sure that you're speaking to your insurance broker, make sure your insurance brokers are speaking to your carriers and your underwriters so that everyone knows exactly what they are covered for. And if they have questions, they should feel free to reach out to their insurance broker, to their underwriters, to anyone they need to make sure that they are getting their questions answered.
And Dan, you want to ask me that question too?
Sure. Go ahead, Ron. What are the key takeaways?
First, gather information from as many reasonably available sources as possible. Gather that information as soon as possible. And if at all possible, you need it at intake. And then you want to remember that patients who do have the capacity to agree or object to disclosure can give consent without signing a written release. And HIPAA does not require that that consent be documented, although it's certainly best to document it in your note. Also remember that HIPAA only regulates what you can or cannot disclose and does not limit your receiving information, so you can factor that information into the patient's care and decisions about interventions and treatment. You also want to remember that there are important exceptions to HIPAA that allow you to disclose information without consent, such as the treatment activities of a healthcare provider exception, the incapacity of the patient, where you're going to make disclosures to those involved in the patient's care, the serious and imminent threat exception, where you make disclosures to those who may be in a position to lessen the threat. And then you want to remember that 42 CFR Part 2 doesn't regulate general medical facilities or individuals whose primary function is not providing substance use disorder treatment. You also want to be sure that your insurance broker is fully informed about your telehealth practices.
That's great information, Ron. Appreciate you providing that. Thank you so much for joining us today. If our listeners want to find out more about you or the Mental Health Risk Retention Group, MHRRG for short, what's the best way to do that?
Thank you, Dan. The best way is to go to our website, which is www.jjnegley.com, or go to the CRC Group Programs section of the CRC Group website, and you can find a link there for us, and all of our contacts are available, and we will put you in touch with who you need to speak to.
Okay. Thank you both for joining us today. I really appreciate it, and we will talk to you again, hopefully soon in the future.
Thank you.
The Placing You First podcast.
A quick note, CRC Group is hiring, and we want you to join our team. CRC is expanding nationwide, opening new offices and hiring at all levels. Join one of the nation's leading wholesale brokers today by finding the careers page on crcgroup.com. Also, stay up to date with everything CRC by following us on LinkedIn. We'd love to start a conversation with you there. And make sure you subscribe to the Tools and Intel newsletter. We send out our latest white papers and reports to our subscribers, and all we need is your email address. It's an easy sign up at crcgroup.com. Thanks for joining us on the Placing You First podcast.
Are you ready to take your career to the next level?
Join Team CRC to gain access to best-in-class tools, data, exclusive programs, and more. Send your resume to resumes@crcgroup.com and read testimonials from our recent hires on LinkedIn. Search for CRC.